Do you follow Vabysmo, Faricimab, SVOA, on LinkedIn? You should. Stay current with our latest updates and hear from leading experts as they share their real-world experiences. Search Vabysmo, that's V-A-B-Y-S-M-O, on LinkedIn to find out more and give us a follow. Content is independently written and developed by HCP Live.
Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series where we'll be discussing how to optimize treatment outcomes in retinal vein occlusion. I am Honglin Hua, Assistant Professor of Clinical Ophthalmology at Bascom Palmer Eye Institute in Miami.
And I'm Shruthi Arapalli, Assistant Professor at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia.
And today we'll be discussing strategies for improving patient outcomes in retinal vein occlusion with anti-VEGF and other therapies. And we are joined by the fantastic Dr. Geeta Lalwani, a vitreoretinal surgeon at the Rocky Mountain Retina Associates in Colorado. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Lalwani.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's get started. Dr. Lalwani, in your opinion, what unique treatments challenges do patients with retinal vein occlusions present compared to those with macular degeneration or diabetic macular edema?
One of the challenging things about RVO is that the onset tends to be very acute, and patients have much less of a background about their condition, right? Usually patients with new onset wet macular degeneration are aware they've had dry macular degeneration in most cases. Patients who develop diabetic macular edema typically are aware that they have diabetes and have a need to follow up. Patients who develop RVO, even though we know, you know, the systemic risk factors, they're not really aware of what can happen. And so they're often shocked by what happens if they do pick it up. And when it does happen, it's much more acute, I think, in most cases than either of those two other diseases. And so the explanation and the conversation that you have with patients is really to step way back and help them understand all of the things that led up to the development of a retinal vein occlusion.
I think those are such fantastic points and really important to note when we're approaching these patients that we have to start from their history and their risk factors. You know, we've talked a little bit about how RVO is different in its onset versus DME and AMD. Dr. Lalwani, do you have a first choice agent for RVOs, or do you sort of treat all patients with retinal macular or vascular disease the same?
Sure. So, I mean, as we all know, reality is insurance often dictates what we use. And so, you know, I guess first and foremost, I always start with an anti-VEGF agent versus steroids or other things. I think the risk profile is much less with anti-VEGFs than with steroids. And right now we're sort of at an interesting time because we have, you know, two new anti-VEGF agents, but only one of which is actually approved for RVO. So Vabysmo, I have to say I've started, you know, using more recently with its approval and have been impressed. But, you know, as we all know, anti-VEGF agents, all of them, Avastin included, all work very well in this patient population by and large. What do you guys do? I'm curious.
You know, I like to keep things simple. I'm earlier in my career, and so I think I can sometimes become a little overwhelmed with all the choices. And so while I try to figure out my algorithm, I like to start everyone on bevacizumab and then go from there and see their response rates.
I have a similar practice. I tend to start my patients on bevacizumab and find that, you know, retinal vein occlusion compared to other vascular diseases like macular edema respond much favorably and quickly to anti-VEGFs. And I find myself, you know, leaning towards other agents less.
Sure.
And so, Dr. Lalwani, how do you manage patients who show a less desirable response or suboptimal response to these anti-VEGFs? While they're fewer, as we discuss, how do you typically address and treat those patients?
So if we start with the bevacizumab, you know, changing anti-VEGFs or switching from anti-VEGF to something entirely different? Is that your question?
Both scenarios. So say someone's responds suboptimally to your initial agent. What's your next step? And what do you reach for next?
So I think one of the questions we're all forced to think about in this day and age is, what is suboptimal response, right? So it's not just not removing fluid, sometimes it's the interval is so short, you know, 4 weeks. I had a patient today. He responds beautifully to, I also started him on bevacizumab. And at 4 weeks, he did great. And when we went to 5 weeks, guess what? The CME came back. And so I consider that suboptimal. You know, this is now the third injection he's had. So I did, you know, get to a point where he had no fluid. So I consider a short interval suboptimal, and typically we'll move to a, from a bevacizumab to one of the branded drugs, be it aflibercept or a faricimab. I don't tend to use ranibizumab much at all for these cases.
Yeah. And just to piggyback a little bit off that suboptimal response point that you made, you know, when you have patients coming into your practice with all these diseases, DME, AMD, and RVOs, you know, do you have a different threshold for what suboptimal is for any of these diseases? And then when you're counseling your patients, do you kind of talk to them differently based on their disease state of what their ultimate response goal should be or what you'd like to see?
Sure. That's complicated. So I think I have almost no tolerance for fluid in RVOs and in AMD. I probably have a little bit more tolerance for fluid in diabetic macular edema, using vision to guide us in those patients. You know, we do see our fair share of patients who've had chronic DME, and they can have almost no fluid and somehow the vision doesn't correlate with that, right? And so I don't tend to be super aggressive in those patients, but in relatively new onset AMD, wet AMD or RVOs, I really don't tolerate fluid much, and work to get to what I call the sweet spot that we all, you know, work to get. I think it's hugely important for patients to understand. And, you know, the OCT is such a fantastic teaching tool. So they know, they're like, doctor, can you show me my pictures? You know, and, oh, there's red today. And then, you know, that sort of thing. And it works to make it a partnership, right? To move forward. I was going to say, how often, so how many times do you guys use a single agent before you switch? I'm curious, to a different agent, like,
I typically will go, you know, three times at that, you know, loading dose interval. And then I think my threshold to switch four time intervals has decreased. So I'm more quicker to switch in this day and age with a larger arsenal of anti-VEGF and other therapeutic agents. I mean, to echo, you know, your algorithm and how much fluid you tolerate, you know, with the DRCR protocol B, we are able to use vision as a kind of goalpost as well on top of the OCT in macular edema patients, whereas I have less tolerance for fluid as well in AMD and RVO patients. And patients love coming to the clinic and looking at the imaging and the OCT, as you mentioned. So I was curious for your retinal vein occlusion patients, what's your utilization of fluorescein angiography look like now? Are you using it more than before, less before? How do you incorporate it?
So honestly, probably less than before. You know, I think that the main utility of vein occlusion is to really measure capillary non-perfusion, right? That's the main utility of fluorescein angiogram in those cases, which I think is different than diabetic macular edema or AMD. So I don't use it nearly as much. And if I, you know, do, if I have patients, you know, I've had a few patients recently where we've just had such chronic CME that no matter what we've used, it hasn't improved. And so I go back and do a fluorescein and use that to guide for any kind of grid PRP, right? And see if that's helpful and to reduce VEGF drive. So that's probably my main utility for using it if I'm suspicious about the way they're responding to anti-VEGF treatments.
Oh, how often are you using grid PRP these days for these recalcitrant patients?
Not often, not often, but I have had a few cases, I will tell you, a few cases that we ended up doing actually focal, And recently I've had probably three out of the blue that we've done it and they have not needed treatment anymore. So I'm much older than you guys. You have to remember that we did not used to have all of these drugs. And so we really had to be creative in our tool, in our toolbox. You know, I mean, I was actually thinking that as we were talking about the drugs. I mean, this is such a fabulous time. You guys don't know what the SCORE study was. I mean, we had no idea what the SCORE study was. That was when we literally only had triamcinolone to put in the eye. And that was my entire residency. We did not have a single anti-VEGF agent. So I have more tools in my toolbox, unfortunately, than you do.
I think it's amazing to hear about, you know, the progression of drugs and what's available to us. You talked about faricimab really nicely earlier. I just wanted to bring us back to that a little bit. So as we know, it's a dual inhibitor of VEGF-A and Ang-2. And can you talk to us a little bit more about what patients you like to utilize that drug for, RVO in particular? Are there other disease states that you find it works well for?
Sure. So, you know, I know that there hasn't been direct scientific evidence of the role of blocking Ang-2, right? Ang-2. But if you look at what Ang-2 does in a detrimental factor, you're like, of course you want to block it. You know, it primes all these vessels to VEGF. And so that alone, if you can reduce that drive by blocking the priming aspect, not to mention the VEGF aspect, it seems like a fantastic idea for, you know, vascular diseases in particular, specifically RVOs and diabetes. And then you look at the downstream effects of Ang-2, you know, with endothelial cell death and apoptosis and things like that, which is a major problem in diabetes in particular. It makes a lot of sense for those two diseases. So if I had to pick based on the science only, I would do that. But because we get to try drugs and see how patients respond, and all of us tend to start off with the switches, right? And switching from one drug to another. I definitely have seen, you know, longer intervals or suboptimal patients actually, you know, get rid of that last remaining lingering fluid, particularly in macular degeneration patients. So I have definitely had some cases that have been wow cases that I've been impressed with. How about you guys?
Yeah, I've as well been able to use faricimab in particular at the VA hospital, where it's a little bit easier to jump through approval processes for our patients. And I've been impressed, especially when I have my diabetic patients who have this resistant fluid. And, you know, for our VA patients, coming back is really hard. They don't always have the social support or transport. And so lessening that burden for them to come into the clinic is really helpful. And I've seen that.
For me, I would say that there have been definitely patients where the durability is greater and the patients are really happy about that. But there's also a factor, you know, we've lived in the brolucizumab era, and that was really great at, it's a really fantastic drying agent. But, you know, of course, there's the safety concerns. And so I found that perhaps faricimab has been a good drying agent, but maybe not as that silver bullet that we had hoped it would be. So speaking of our armamentarium of drugs, which patients do you consider adding steroids to in addition with the anti-VEGFs?
Obviously, the patients that are suboptimal responders, you know, we're talking about RVO here, right, specifically. So the suboptimal responders who I really just cannot get them to extend their interval, or more commonly, honestly, is that the CME is just not as responsive to anti-VEGFs. And so there's persistent lingering CME. I do find the side effect of cataract challenging. You know, I have conversations with people about all the time about, you know, how much do you worry about it? And obviously, if the patient's older, then it's less of a problem. When you have a patient who's, you know, 40s, 50s, even early 60s, who really doesn't have a cataract, I do think about it. So that's why I tend not to use it. So, and then there's also the steroid response, which we're all aware of. And so it takes a little bit more conversations and management. But like I said, if they have persistent CME that we really cannot extend, I have probably a lower threshold to switch than I have in the past because I've seen such a good response.
And to work off that question just a little bit, in addition to CME for patients with RVO, is there anything else on your OCT that you'll look for that might kind of clue you into, oh, I think I want to try a steroid in this patient sooner?
So I don't know. I was thinking about that in terms of the question about OCT biomarkers, right? Of things that we look at. And we talk about chronic CME. I don't have a good definition of what chronic CME looks like. You know, I guess maybe larger cystic changes, a little bit more raggedy looking. I don't know if you guys have a better, I can see you nodding your heads. And you know what I'm talking about. If you could put it into words better than I can, please do. But on those patients, I tend to like to jump to a steroid faster.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, it's hard to describe, but I think we all know what it looks like when we see it.
Yeah.
We have that kind of instinct of maybe I need a steroid here. So I agree completely.
Yeah, for diabetic macular edema, I think there's data out there to show that subretinal fluid and these persistent hyperreflective foci are also good biomarkers. And so I'll kind of extrapolate that to retinal vein occlusions as well for patients who aren't ideal responders. And so with these evolving anti-VEGF agents on the market, how has your algorithm for approaching macular edema and retinal vein occlusion patients changed? Are you quicker to switch agents? Are you reaching for steroids later than you typically would or sooner or in conjunction? How do you approach these patients?
I think I'm actually quicker to switch agents, whatever agent it is. You know, I look at it and say, you know, I'm just not getting the response that I would expect. And I know I have an idea of how long it should take. You know, after the first injection and you see the response, you have an idea of how long it's going to take a patient to get where you expect them to be. So honestly, after one and two injections, I'd like to be able to switch to a different agent. I think I reach for steroids probably sooner than I have in the past. The irony, though, as you know, is step therapy is 3 injections, and they're very strict on that. And so it's a challenge. I think the intersection with insurances is really, I guess it's an added challenge to the managing step therapy with these patients, as well as trying to treat them medically, it's all an added challenge rolled into one.
Absolutely. And then I had one final question, you know, hearkening back to the pathophysiology of retinal vein occlusion. And, you know, I hadn't thought about how it can be much more sudden for these patients and how less educated they may be. How do you have a discussion with patients when they have especially a devastating ischemic retinal vein occlusion? And how do you explain that, you know, we may get a little bit of vision back, but unfortunately there's a permanent vision loss that's happened?
So I probably don't have that conversation up front with patients. My first is to sort of get them to where we are. And I really talk about, you know what, at this point, I will manage your eye. We will do the best we can, but you have to understand that this is a red flag for your brain, your heart, your kidneys. I really have that conversation exactly like that and say, we have got to get your body as fine-tuned as possible because you don't want to have a stroke. And I think having a stroke scares everybody to actually go to see their primary care doctor. So I start with that. And then we talk about, you know, I use analogies a lot with my patients for them to understand. And I say, well, your eye's a bathtub, your bathtub has a clot in it and all the water backed up and now your carpet's soaking wet. And I said, I am sure that I can dry up that carpet, but that carpet may not be as functional as if it never got soaking wet. And so I think patients understand that the goal is to dry up the carpet. And so when they look at the pictures, now it makes a whole lot of sense of a soaking wet carpet, you know, and it lends itself for a lot of humor because who the heck has carpet in the bathroom anymore? <You know? laughs> So it's a nice icebreaker to have the conversation, but I think it really it's very easy for patients to visualize what we're trying to achieve and what we might be left with, even if we achieve, you know, quote unquote, a dry carpet, and what the vision may or may not be. The harder part, I think, is explaining the risk of neovascular glaucoma, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the need to come back and, you know, I don't see well anyway, but we need to watch you to make sure that we don't have, super high pressure occur.
Absolutely. I love that analogy, and I may be stealing it moving forward with my own patients.
It works well. It works well.
Well, Dr. Lalwani, I've learned so much from you today. Thank you so much for joining us on our MedCast series on retinal vein occlusions.
Thank you both for having me. This was so fun to do with you guys.